Chapter 5. I am glad it cannot happen twice, the fever of first love. For it is a fever, and a burden too, whatever the poets may say. They are not brave, the days when we are 21. They are full of little cowardices, little fears without foundation, and one is so easily bruised, so swiftly wounded, one falls to the first barbed word. Today, wrapped in the complacent armour of approaching middle age, the infinitesimal pricks of day by day brush one lightly and are soon forgotten. But then, how a careless word would linger, becoming a fiery stigma, and how a look, a glance over a shoulder, branded themselves as things eternal. A denial heralded the thrice crowing of a cock, and an insincerity was like the kiss of Judas. The adult mind can lie with untroubled conscience and a gay composure, but in those days even a small deception scoured the tongue, lashing one against the stake itself. "What have you been doing this morning?" I can hear her now, propped against her pillows with all the small irritability of the patient who is not really ill, who has lain in bed too long, and I, reaching to the bedside drawer for the pack of cards, would feel the guilty flush form patches on my neck. "I've been playing tennis with a professional," I told her, the false words bringing me to panic even as I spoke, for what if the professional himself should come up to the suite then, that very afternoon, and bursting in upon her complain that I had missed my lesson now for many days? "The trouble is, with me laid up like this, you haven't got enough to do," she said, mashing her cigarette in a jar of cleansing cream, and taking the cards in her hand, she mixed them in the deft, irritating shuffle of the inveterate player, shaking them in threes, snapping the backs. "I don't know what you find to do with yourself all day," she went on. "You never have any sketches to show me, and when I do ask you to do some shopping for me, you forget to buy my Taxol. All I can say is that I hope your tennis will improve. It will be useful to you later on. A poor player is a great bore. Do you still serve underhand?" She flipped the Queen of Spades into the pool, and the dark face stared up at me like Jezebel. "Yes," I said, stung by her question, thinking how just and appropriate her word. It described me well. I was underhand. I had not played tennis with the professional at all. I had not once played since she had lain in bed. And that was a little over a fortnight now. I wondered why it was I clung to this reserve, and why it was I did not tell her that every morning I drove with De Winter in his car and lunched with him, too, at his table in the restaurant. "You must come up to the net more. You will never play a good game until you do," she continued. And I agreed, flinching at my own hypocrisy, covering the queen with the weak-chinned knave of hearts. I have forgotten much of Monte Carlo, of those morning drives, of where we went, even our conversation. But I have not forgotten how my fingers trembled, cramming on my hat, and how I ran along the corridor and down the stairs, too impatient to wait for the slow whining of the lift, and so outside, brushing the swing doors before the commissionaire could help me. He would be there, in the driver's seat, reading a paper while he waited, and when he saw me he would smile, and toss it behind him in the back seat, and open the door, saying, "Well, how is the friend of the bosom this morning, and where does she want to go?" If he had driven round in circles, it would not have mattered to me. For I was in that first flushed stage, when to climb into the seat beside him and lean forward to the windscreen hugging my knees was almost too much to bear. I was like a little scrubby schoolboy with a passion for a sixth-form prefect, and he kinder and far more inaccessible.
"There's a cold wind this morning. You'd better put on my coat."
I remember that, for I was young enough to win happiness in the wearing of his clothes, playing the schoolboy again who carries his hero's sweater and ties it about his throat, choking with pride. And this borrowing of his coat, wearing it around my shoulders for even a few minutes at a time, was a triumph in itself and made a glow about my morning. Not for me the languor and the subtlety I had read about in books, the challenge and the chase, the sword play, the swift glance, the stimulating smile. The art of provocation was unknown to me,
and I would sit with his map upon my lap, the wind blowing my dull, lanky hair, happy in his silence, yet eager for his words. Whether he talked or not made little difference to my mood. My only enemy was the clock on the dashboard, whose hands would move relentlessly to 1 o'clock. We drove east, we drove west, amidst the myriad villages that cling like limpets to the Mediterranean shore. And today, I remember none of them. All I remember is the feel of the leather seats, the texture of the map upon my knee, its frayed edges, its worn seams, and how one day, looking at the clock, I thought to myself, this moment now, at 11:20, this must never be lost. And I shut my eyes to make the experience more lasting. When I opened my eyes, we were by a bend in the road, and a peasant girl in a black shawl waved to us. I can see her now, her dusty skirt, her gleaming, friendly smile, and in a second we had passed the bend and could see her no more. Already she belonged to the past. She was only a memory. I wanted to go back again, to recapture the moment that had gone, and then it came to me that if we did, it would not be the same. Even the sun would be changed in the sky, casting another shadow, and the peasant girl would trudge past us along the road in a different way, not waving this time, perhaps not even seeing us. There was something chilling in the thought, something a little melancholy, and looking at the clock, I saw that 5 more minutes had gone by. Soon we would have reached our time limit, and must return to the hotel. If only there could be an invention, I said impulsively, that bottled up a memory like scent, and it never faded, and it never got stale, and then, when one wanted it, the bottle could be uncorked, and it would be like living the moment all over again. I looked up at him to see what he would say. He did not turn to me. He went on watching the road ahead. What particular moments in your young life do you wish uncorked? He said. I could not tell from his voice whether he was teasing me or not. I'm not sure, I began, and then blundered on rather foolishly, not thinking of my words. I'd like to keep this moment and never forget it. Is that meant to be a compliment to the day or to my driving? He said. And as he laughed, like a mocking brother, I became silent, overwhelmed suddenly by the great gulf between us, and how his very kindness to me widened it. I knew then that I would never tell Mrs. Van Hopper about these morning expeditions, for her smile would hurt me as his laugh had done. She would not be angry, nor would she be shocked. She would raise her eyebrows very faintly, as though she did not altogether believe my story, and then with a tolerant shrug of the shoulder she would say, "My dear child, it's extremely sweet and kind of him to take you driving. The only thing is, are you sure it does not bore him dreadfully?" And then she would send me out to buy Taxol, patting me on the shoulder. What degradation lay in being young, I thought, and fell to tearing my nails. "I wish," I said savagely, still mindful of his laugh and throwing discretion to the wind, "I wish I was a woman of about 36, dressed in black satin with a string of pearls."
"You would not be in this car with me if you were," he said. "And stop biting those nails. They're ugly enough already."
"You'll think me impertinent and rude, I dare say," I went on. "But I would like to know why you ask me to come out in the car day after day. You're being kind, that's obvious. But why do you choose me for your charity?" I sat up stiff and straight in my seat, and with all the poor pomposity of youth.
"I ask you," he said gravely, "because you are not dressed in black satin with a string of pearls, nor are you 36. His face was without expression. I could not tell whether he laughed inwardly or not.
"It's all very well," I said. "You know everything there is to know about me. There's not much, I admit, because I have not been alive for very long, and nothing much has happened to me, except people dying. But you, I know nothing more about you than I did the first day we met."
"And what did you know then?" he asked.
"Why, that you had lived at Manderley, and that you had lost your wife." There, I had said it at last. The word that had hovered on my tongue for days. "Your wife. It came out with ease, without reluctance, as though the mere mention of her must be the most casual thing in all the world. Your wife. The word lingered in the air once I had uttered it, dancing before me, and because he received it silently, making no comment, the word magnified itself into something heinous and appalling, a forbidden word, unnatural to the tongue. And I could not call it back. It could never be unsaid. Once again I saw the inscription on the flyleaf of that book of poems, and the curious, slanting R. I felt sick at heart and cold. He would never forgive me, and this would be the end of our friendship. I remember staring straight in front of me at the windscreen, seeing nothing of the flying road, my ears still tingling with that spoken word. The silence became minutes, and the minutes became miles. And everything is over now, I thought. I shall never drive with him again. Tomorrow he will go away, and Mrs. Van Hopper will be up again. She and I will walk along the terrace as we did before. The porter will bring down his trunks. I shall catch a glimpse of them in the luggage lift, with new plastered labels, the bustle and finality of departure, the sound of the car changing gear as it turned the corner, and then even that sound merging into the common traffic and being lost, and so absorbed for ever. I was so deep in my picture, I even saw the porter pocketing his tip and going back through the swing door of the hotel, saying something over his shoulder to the commissionaire, that I did not notice the slowing down of the car, and it was only when we stopped, drawing up by the side of the road, that I brought myself back to the present once again. He sat motionless, looking without his hat and with his white scarf round his neck, more than ever like someone medieval who lived within a frame. He did not belong to the bright landscape. He should be standing on the steps of a gaunt cathedral, his cloak flung back, while a beggar at his feet scrambled for gold coins. The friend had gone, with his kindliness and his easy camaraderie, and the brother, too, who had mocked me for nibbling at my nails. This man was a stranger. I wondered why I was sitting beside him in the car. Then he turned to me and spoke. "A little while ago you talked about an invention," he said, "some scheme for capturing a memory. You would like, you told me, at a chosen moment, to live the past again. I'm afraid I think rather differently from you. All memories are bitter, and I prefer to ignore them. Something happened a year ago that altered my entire life, and I want to forget every phase in my existence up to that time. Those days are finished. They're blotted out. I must begin living all over again. The first day we met, your Mrs. Van Hopper asked me why I came to Monte Carlo. It put a stopper on those memories you would like to resurrect. It does not always work, of course. Sometimes the scent is too strong for the bottle and too strong for me. And then the devil in one, like a furtive peeping Tom, tries to draw the cork. I did that in the first drive we took together, when we climbed the hills and looked down over the precipice. I was there some years ago with my wife. You asked me if it was still the same, if it had changed at all. It was just the same, but, I was thankful to realize, oddly impersonal. There was no suggestion of the other time. She and I had left no record. It may have been because you were with me. You have blotted out the past for me, you know, far more effectively than all the bright lights of Monte Carlo. But for you, I should have left long ago. Gone on to Italy. And Greece, and further still, perhaps. You have spared me all those wanderings. Damn your puritanical little tight-lipped speech to me. Damn your idea of my kindness and my charity. I ask you to come with me because I want you and your company. And if you don't believe me, you can leave the car now and find your own way home. Go on, open the door and get out. I sat still, my hands in my lap, not knowing whether he meant it or not. "Well," he said, "what are you going to do about it?" Had I been a year or two younger,
I think I should have cried. Children's tears are very near the surface and come at the first crisis. As it was, I felt them prick behind my eyes, felt the reddy colour flood my face, and catching a sudden glimpse of myself in the glass above the windscreen, saw in full the sorry spectacle that I made, with troubled eyes and scarlet cheeks, lank hair flopping under broad felt hat. "I want to go home," I said, my voice perilously near to trembling, and without a word he started up the engine, let in the clutch, and turned the car round the way that we had come. Swiftly we covered the ground. Far too swiftly, I thought, far too easily, and the callous countryside watched us with indifference. We came to the bend in the road that I had wished to imprison as a memory, and the peasant girl was gone, and the colour was flat, and it was no more, after all, than any bend in any road passed by 100 motorists. The glamour of it had gone with my happy mood, and at the thought of it, my frozen face quivered into feeling. My adult pride was lost, and those despicable tears rejoicing at their conquest welled into my eyes and strayed upon my cheeks. I could not check them, for they came unbidden, and had I reached in my pocket for a handkerchief, he would have seen. I must let them fall untouched and suffer the bitter salt upon my lips, plumbing the depths of humiliation. Whether he had turned his head to look at me, I do not know, for I watched the road ahead with blurred and steady stare. But suddenly he put out his hand and took hold of mine and kissed it, still saying nothing, and then he threw his handkerchief on my lap, which I was too ashamed to touch. I thought of all those heroines of fiction who looked pretty when they cried, and what a contrast I must make with blotched and swollen face and red rims to my eyes. It was a dismal finish to my morning, and the day that stretched ahead of me was long. I had to lunch with Mrs. Van Hopper in her room because the nurse was going out, and afterwards she would make me play bézique with all the tireless energy of the convalescent. I knew I should stifle in that room. There was something sordid about the tumbled sheets, the sprawling blankets, and the thumped pillows, and that bedside table dusty with powder, spilt scent, and melting liquid rouge. Her bed would be littered with the separated sheets of the daily papers, folded anyhow, while French novels with curling edges and the covers torn kept company with American magazines. The mash stubs of cigarettes lay everywhere, in cleansing cream, in a dish of grapes, and on the floor beneath the bed. Visitors were lavish with their flowers, and the vases stood cheek by jowl in any fashion, hothouse exotics crammed beside mimosa, while a great beribboned casket crowned them all, with tier upon tier of crystallized fruit. Later her friends would come in for a drink, which I must mix for them, hating my task, shy and ill at ease in my corner, hemmed in by their parrot chatter, and I would be a whipping boy again, blushing for her, when, excited by her little crowd, she must sit up in bed and talk too loudly, laugh too long, reach to the portable gramophone and start a record, shrugging her large shoulders to the tune. I preferred her irritable and snappy, her hair done up in pins, scolding me for forgetting her taxol. All this awaited me in the suite, while he, once he had left me at the hotel, would go away somewhere alone, towards the sea, perhaps, feel the wind on his cheek, follow the sun, and it might happen that he would lose himself in those memories that I knew nothing of, that I could not share. He would wander down the years that were gone. The gulf that lay between us was wider now than it had ever been, and he stood away from me with his back turned on the further shore. I felt young and small and very much alone, and now, in spite of my pride, I found his handkerchief and blew my nose, throwing my drab appearance to the winds. It could never matter. "The hell with this," he said suddenly, as though angry, as though bored, and he pulled me beside him and put his arm round my shoulder, still looking straight ahead of him, his right hand on the wheel. He drove, I remember, even faster than before. "I suppose you're young enough to be my daughter, and I don't know how to deal with you," he said. The road narrowed then to a corner, and he had to swerve to avoid a dog. I thought he would release me, but he went on holding me beside him, and when the corner was passed and the road came straight again, he did not let me go. "You can forget all I said to you this morning," he said. "That's all finished and done with. Don't let's ever think of it again. My family always call me Maxim. I'd like you to do the same. You've been formal with me long enough.
He felt for the brim of my hat and took hold of it, throwing it over his shoulder to the back seat, and then bent down and kissed the top of my head.
"Promise me you will never wear black satin," he said.
I smiled then, and he laughed back at me. And the morning was gay again. The morning was a shining thing. Mrs. Van Hopper and the afternoon did not matter a flip of the finger. It would pass so quickly, and there would be tonight, and another day tomorrow. I was cocksure, jubilant. At that moment, I almost had the courage to claim equality. I saw myself strolling into Mrs. Van Hopper's bedroom rather late for my bezique, and when questioned by her, yawning carelessly, saying, "I forgot the time, I've been lunching with Maxim." I was still child enough to consider a Christian name like a plume in the hat, though from the very first he had called me by mine. The morning, for all its shadowed moments, had promoted me to a new level of friendship. I did not lag so far behind as I thought. He had kissed me, too, a natural business, comforting and quiet. Not dramatic as in books, not embarrassing. It seemed to bring about an ease in our relationship. It made everything more simple. The gulf between us had been bridged after all. I was to call him Maxim, and that afternoon playing bezique with Mrs. Van Hopper was not so tedious as it might have been, though my courage failed me and I said nothing of my mourning. For when, gathering her cards together at the end and reaching for the box, she said casually, "Tell me, is Max de Winter still in the hotel?" I hesitated a moment, like a diver on the brink, then lost my nerve and my tutored self-possession, saying, "Yes, I believe so. He comes into the restaurant for his meals." "Someone has told her," I thought. "Someone has seen us together. The tennis professional has complained. The manager has sent a note," and I waited for her attack. But she went on putting the cards back into the box, yawning a little while I straightened the tumbled bed. I gave her the bowl of powder, the rouge compact, and the lipstick, and she put away the cards and took up the hand glass from the table by her side. "Attractive creature," she said, "but queer-tempered, I should think, difficult to know. I thought he might have made some gesture of asking one to Manderley that day in the lounge, but he was very close." I said nothing. I watched her pick up the lipstick and outline a bow upon her hard mouth. "I never saw her," she said, holding the glass away to see the effect. "But I believe she was very lovely, exquisitely turned out and brilliant in every way. They used to give tremendous parties at Manderley. It was all very sudden and tragic, and I believe he adored her. I need the darker shade of powder with this brilliant red, my dear. Fetch it, will you? And put this box back in the drawer." And we were busy then with powder, scent, and rouge, until the bell rang and her visitors came in. I handed them their drinks, dully, saying little. I changed the records on the gramophone. I threw away the stubs of cigarettes.
"Been doing any sketching lately, little lady?"
The forced heartiness of an old banker, his monocle dangling on a string and my bright smile of insincerity. "No, not very lately. Will you have another cigarette?" It was not I that answered. I was not there at all. I was following a phantom in my mind, whose shadowy form had taken shape at last. Her features were blurred, her colouring indistinct. The setting of her eyes and the texture of her hair was still uncertain, still to be revealed. She had beauty that endured, and a smile that was not forgotten. Somewhere her voice still lingered, and the memory of her words. There were places she had visited, and things that she had touched. Perhaps in cupboards there were clothes that she had worn, with the scent about them still. In my bedroom, under my pillow, I had a book that she had taken in her hands, and I could see her turning to that first white page, smiling as she wrote, and shaking the bent nib. "Max, from Rebecca." It must have been his birthday, and she had put it amongst her other presents on the breakfast table, and they had laughed together as he tore off the paper and string. She leant, perhaps, over his shoulder while he read, "Max." She called him Max. It was familiar, gay, and easy on the tongue. The family could call him Maxim if they liked, grandmothers and aunts, and people like myself, quiet and dull and youthful, who did not matter. Max was her choice. The word was her possession. She had written it with so great a confidence on the flyleaf of that book, that bold, slanting hand stabbing the white paper, the symbol of herself so certain, so assured. How many times she must have written to him thus, in how many varied moods. Little notes scrawled on half sheets of paper, and letters when he was away, page after page, intimate, their news. Her voice echoing through the house and down the garden, careless and familiar like the writing in the book. And I had to call him Maxim.